This is a Collider.com audio interview.
I guess I have to start by saying I am a little mad at you. And it's because I'm like a huge fan of your work, and I have to say I'm a little disappointed that you're stepping away for who knows for how long. So as I speak for all fandom when I just want to express frustration.
Well, thank you. I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, you know. Even if I were to start up again, I've already set things in motion that would delay that by a couple of years. So at the very least, it's going to be a few years, and then we'll see. We'll see how I feel.
To be honest, though, as a fan of yours, I just want you to be happy. I'm disappointed as just a fan, just I want to see more movies, because but I understand if you want to do other things, and I think I speak for most fans who just want you to be creative and doing...
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be different stuff. I don't think I could ever sit still and do nothing, but it's just going to be different stuff in the hopes that maybe by exploring some other avenues, I can find another way into this job and reboot somehow. But something, you know, it's something I've been planning for a while, and I get those feelings of you know, I know something's got to change. And so, you know, 5 years ago where I decided pretty much to follow the plan that I followed.
Are you, because I've heard rumors about writing and painting and just a whole bunch of stuff. Is that, are you a prolific painter?
Not yet. I've painted a little. I've got a lot of work to do. You can't get good at anything unless you do it, you know, day in and day out, over and over. And so I'm just now getting to the point where I have enough time to practice. You know, I'm in that phase of just trying to learn how to do very basic things that I've seen, you know, that I like. And it's the same process as learning how to make a movie. You see something you like, you go out and try and imitate it, try and figure out how they did it. And it's going to take a while. It's going to take a while. But I have I've got time. I've bought myself some time. So it could be a while before I generate anything that I want to, you know, put out there. But I'm putting up a website maybe March, early April. So that, and, you know, whatever I'm up to will be there, or you'll be able to know what it is, or, you know, that'll be my portal to the outside world.
Do you have does it have a URL yet?
Extension 765.
I'm a huge fan of the Impressionist movement in the late 1800s. Is there a certain movement that really you gravitate towards, or are you a fan of all paintings?
I think for now, I like a lot of different... It's like movies. I like a lot of different kinds of movies. I like a lot of different kinds of painting. At this point, I've been going back and forth between portraits and just pure abstract stuff. So I don't know where that... I don't know where that'll lead, you know. And then I've been doing collages. There's going to be one book on filmmaking, one more book on filmmaking. I'm about a quarter of the way through now. That I'll put up on the site when it's done. I'll self-publish that. So, you know, I'm going to do Scott's play in the fall. Probably going to do Cleo on stage next year, I hope. So there's stuff.
He mentioned he was doing something on Columbine.
Yeah.
And that's very...
Yeah, we had a read-through in New York the day before Newtown.
Wow.
It was really weird. So it's a really interesting piece, I think. And when you say, if you were to say to somebody, oh, I'm doing a piece on Columbine, when you see what it is, it's not at all what you would expect. He found a really fascinating avenue into it, and it's not about guns, it's not about that debate, it's about something else. So
I'm curious your take right now, and we're going to get into side effects, of course, but I'm just curious your take on the whole Kickstarter thing right now, and people being able to do... I mean, it's a very, very exciting time for everything in terms
of... Well, look, what's great about all this technology and things like Kickstarter is it enables me finally, and without any bad feeling at all, when people come up to me now saying, you know, I want to do this, I want to, I can just go, there are no excuses anymore.
I'm waiting for the person who's going to finally say, like, a big filmmaker who is having a problem with the studio who needs, say, $50 million. Do you think it's possible for someone to really put together this mega budget thing that the studios would never approve and actually get it going on Kickstarter? Do you think that will ever happen?
I wouldn't be surprised if we see that happen at some point on a scale that's significant. But I think, I'm not even clear. Now, how does this work exactly? I put money into a Kickstarter thing. Do I get it back?
If you, basically, when someone creates a Kickstarter, say it's for 30 days, I believe that's what it is. So say they want to target $100,000. Everyone who puts in money, if they reach the target, until they reach the target, you are committing to something that is not going to be taken, like a credit card will not be charged anything until they reach the target. Once they get the target, then the money gets funneled into the account they set up, and I guess it's like the honor system. Like, you're just believing that they're going to do what they say.
Right.
From what I understand, most people are pretty honest about this.
But don't they explain to you, like, oh, if you put in this money, you know, you're going to get a shirt that says
levels where it could be like $10, you get this, $50, you get this, and ultimately there will be a few that are very expensive that really give you a lot of VIP perks, and that's where, you know, they can really get ahead.
But it's mostly not designed to sort of pay people back their money.
No, it's about getting something made, like a product, or a film, or a documentary.
Right.
I put in money for a really cool thing that this British inventor did to help deactivate landmines. And it's like this plasticky device, a big ball, and it can really save a lot of lives.
Right.
And I felt, you know, for me, that was worth my money.
Right.
So I'm hoping it works out.
Interesting.
That's just a whole nother thing.
Yeah, no, look, I like I said, I'm... What I used to say to people all the time was, don't wait for permission, you know. But now, at least, you know, you can... It's shocking what you can make for nothing that looks... You can make incredible-looking shit now.
Yeah.
It's great. So, you know, that's the good news. Anybody can make something, and the bad news is everybody is.
I'm curious about digital cameras. What has been, right now, every director and cinematographer I talk to is either the Arri Alexa, the Red Epic, or recently the Sony F65. I'm curious your take on the digital cameras that are available right now.
Well, I think...
I'm not trying to corner you into...
No. Look, I have a long history with Red, so I'm partial to Red. I like the way it looks. I like the way it works. I like its size. You know, the Sony camera, that's a nice image, but the thing is a boat anchor. I mean, that's not, you know... When I first saw the Panavision Genesis, I knew that wasn't going to work because it was bigger than a Panaflex. The whole point is, like, we want it smaller. I mean, the thing about the Epic, you know, which you can record full, you know, full resolution without being connected to anything. You know, we have that shot in Side Effects where Rooney puts her foot on the gas. I just stripped everything off the body and stuck the camera behind the gas pedal. You know, normally you'd have to saw the car. You'd have to saw a hole in the car to get that shot. You know, that's the shit I want. I want to be able to put it wherever I want. And so that combined with the sort of ethos of that company, which is they are constantly upgrading. They've got a new sensor coming out, the Dragon, that's fucking insane. Like, it's a whole other level in terms of dynamic range, resolution. Like, it's crazy. I've seen the tests on it. It's nuts. I mean, these guys just stay up really late, you know, and, like, they're just never satisfied, and they're constantly pushing it. So I look at it as, you know, if you want to be, if you're conservative, you should probably use something other than the Red. If you're someone who really likes to live dangerously and sort of push stuff, then you should be using the red because that's where it's at its best. You know, a lot of these cameras, you use them and they have text there saying, don't do that. You know, you're, you know, don't do that. You've got, and, you know, whereas with red, you know, we'll shoot stuff that'll come back. You know, Jim Gennaro will look at it and go, wow, I didn't know somebody was going to do that with our camera. Great. You know, let's figure out, you know, how to turn, you know, what most people would look at as a problem into like our next, you know, firmware upgrade.
Sure.
You know, they're just constantly tweaking. And so I'm, and it's a great story too, because it's him. You know, he's like Howard Hughes. Like, he had the idea, he had the money, he put the super group together, they went and did it. And it's, that's the way innovation happens. You know what I mean? It's not, and he's a guy, he's a gearhead, he's a camera guy. He wanted to design something. A lot of these things you look at and you go, clearly the people that designed this have never had to use one of these. Because no one would ever, if you knew you were going to put that on your shoulder, you wouldn't design it that way. And Jim was a photographer. Like, he really canvassed a lot of people and said, what do you want? You know, what do you want in this? And literally talk about how big should it be? How much should it weigh? You know, what should it look like? What should the weight distribution of it be? Like, what kind of, you know, kind of lens mounts do you think it should have? What kind, you know, he was trying to make something that, you know, you could use with your hands that felt intuitive. So I'm really happy that I ended up being a part of that narrative of the development of that camera, because it was exciting to watch. And the product itself has like completely changed the way I've been able to work. My only regret is I wish I'd had it 10 years ago.
I'm curious, when do you think digital cameras are going to hit the resolution or the ability that anyone using film is going to say it's time to switch?
They've already done it. They're just, film people are just in denial. They've already done it. They passed them a couple of years ago.
Okay, let me ask you this question. When do you think digital cameras will get to doing what IMAX can do, if ever?
Oh, they will. I mean, the new Dragon 6K is crazy. Like, take the new Dragon sensor, put a master prime on it, shoot it at a decent f-stop, and do a line pairs test, you know, where you have this chart that has a series of lines on it that are, you know, and let's see.
I don't know the resolution of the Dragon versus what the Red Epic was doing right now.
Right.
Is it like 50% better? Is it 20? Is it 100%?
I don't know. It's a lot.
So it's
noticeable.
It's very. I wonder if Mr. Jackson is going to shoot with that on when he does the additional photography on Hobbit.
I don't know, but you know, if you were going to blend. You know, I don't think you'd want to blend it with the Epic, but I don't know. I mean, Peter's off on a frolic of his own, so...
Right. You know. what's funny is this is completely out of order of what I wanted to do, but while we're talking about this, I definitely want to know your take, if you don't mind talking about it, on the high frame rate that Peter's doing.
There's a technical reason why I think that frame rate is weird. And it has to do with your brain's ability to scan, you know, beyond a certain rate. And the point is, I find it looks weird. And there was an article written a couple of months ago by, you know, a neuroscientist explaining why it is always going to look weird. Your brain is never going to rewire to have this look normal, quote unquote normal, because at beyond a certain frame rate, like, we lose the ability to sort of take it all in. So it is always going to look like, as people say, it's always going to look like video. Like, it's never not. And I find that weird, you know.
Do you think that the high frame, because I saw it twice, once at Warner Brothers and once in IMAX, and I found the IMAX presentation to be much better.
Mm-hmm.
But I am curious if the high frame rate might be more applicable towards documentaries or things, you know, because it really is kicking the glass out of the window.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just wondering, like, for me, I'm not I'm not sold on it, but I'm also not against it.
Right.
But I think it's maybe more applicable for certain genres or certain things.
Yeah, maybe. You know, it definitely, you know, I just find it, it interferes with my suspension of disbelief, you know, is my personal issue.
I think that there were certain sequences in The Hobbit, for me, that it did the same thing, and others where I found it very compelling.
Right.
But switching back, and let's jump into your movie now. Originally, Scott was trying to make this his directorial debut.
No, he's made a movie.
Well, I mean, oh, sorry, that's my bad. He was going to make this as he wanted to direct this.
Yeah.
And he was explaining to me how, you know, he really liked the script and, you know, was it weird for you, because you're very close to him, to sort of, like, what was that conversation like, you know, because he's been trying for a while.
It seemed to not be that big a deal in the sense that, you know, I called him right after Man from U.N.C.L.E. blew up, you know, and just said, I really wanted to work with you this spring. You know, will you give me... I won't ask you again, but we, you know, can I have Side Effects? And he said, yeah. And then we kind of never talked about it again. I think it would have been weird if we didn't have the history that we have. You know what I mean? Like, we've worked together twice before, three times before. Like, we worked on the U.N.C.L.E. script for a year. So, I mean, I think if it had been someone else, it probably would have been a more difficult decision for him than it was. But it seemed, you know, he knew how much I liked it. And, you know, I think he felt, yeah, let's just go do it. You know, he's one of these guys, he's got tons of ideas. Like, his attitude was, I'll write something else, you know, and he does. You know, he's very prolific and very facile. And so I don't think he didn't exhibit any of the kind of proprietary attitude that I think a lot of writers would have, you know. I think he felt like, yeah, I got other stuff.
When you got the script from him, and how much do you change scripts based on actors' involvement? Because a lot of actors will come to the plate and then say, okay, I want to do this, but I want to make it this dramatic change to the arc.
Right.
You know, how much are you, and over the course of your history, how much have you adjusted your film to an actor, or is it sort of like each project's different?
It depends, yeah. It really depends on the project. Sometimes there's a lot of work to be done, and it's great to have somebody come in, you know, with a different perspective. You know, I've been in a situation where I've gone to an actor with a script. They've said, I like the project, but I don't think this character is working. And we've gone off and worked with another actor who said, I want to do the movie, but I think there's work to be done on the character. They've worked with us, then bailed on the movie, and then I went back to the original actor, and they went, you solved it, I'm in. Like, that's happened to me before. But it really depends on the piece, and I think in the last few years, there's been less of that because I think the scripts from the get-go have been more done, you know, like very, so there, you'll have actors coming in who will have a lot of questions about things to make sure that they're in line with what we're intending. But in the last few years, the scripts have sort of been pretty good shape. You know, by the time we started casting, there was you know, that me and the writer had kind of beaten it to death, and there wasn't really a lot of, you know, there wasn't a lot of room for somebody coming in and just kind of rethinking a character. Now, having said that, in post on Contagion, we did a lot of work. And ended up going back and doing, you know, a week of reshooting to accommodate a version of the movie that was created in the editing room that was very different from the script. So that was an interesting circumstance because we had a movie that wasn't working at the length that we shot it, And then we did a really radical 90-minute cut that solved a lot of problems, but in order to work needed some connective tissue.
Sure.
And so we went and got, we shot stuff to make the 90-minute version work. And so that was a pretty dramatic overhaul in post. And, you know, and Scott's, you know, obviously Scott and I, I'm the one sort of saying to Scott, this is what I think we should be doing. You know, look at this cut. I think we need scenes. I think we need to redo these scenes, and then we need scenes to connect here to here to here. You know, those typically, those, if you're going to be talking to the actors, it's more to explain why you're doing what you're doing than to solicit input. And so that's a lot different than, God, I remember we had like a week of rehearsals on Sex Lies, and now I think, God, what did we talk about for a week? You know, I mean, that's, we had 30, that's the most, Sex Lies was the only time I think I've ever felt on a set that we had like all the time in the world, you know, where I never felt under any time constraints at all. Because I think of that movie now, we have 30 days to shoot, I could shoot that thing in 12 days, you know. I just remember just sitting there, you know, just like that, we were not in a hurry. Which was fine, you know. It was a cheap movie anyway. You know, we only had 10 people on the crew. So.
Oh, how times have changed.
Yeah, I know. I know.
A lot of directors, like Clint Eastwood, likes 2 takes, if you're lucky. Fincher likes 50. Where do you fall on that scale?
I fall mostly toward the let's keep it fresh. You know, 3 is my ideal. But there was one scene that ended up getting cut significantly. I'm only using the front part of it now in Side Effects, where it was a long dialogue scene that I wanted to play out in one shot, and there was a lot of movement in it. So there were like 7 different destinations for the camera. We did 23 takes before we got it. You know, if that's what it requires, I'll do it. But in general, if there's not a big technical thing going on, I feel like unless there's something wrong, we ought to be able to, with the text,
sure,
you know, or the actor, you know, 3 takes, we ought to be thinking of moving on.
I don't know what the final running time is on Side Effects. What is it?
I think total with credits, 105 minutes.
What was your assembly cut on it?
2 hours.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't too long.
So there's not a lot of deleted scenes.
There are, but a lot of them are scenes. There's some. You'd be surprised how many. A lot of them just, it's that trial and error thing of like, oh, people are ahead of us. Like they'll make that leap. You know that,
sure,
he goes from here to here. A lot of it though, what you would find is scenes that just got, like I said, I cut the entire back two-thirds of it off, or I cut the entire front 2/3 of it off. You know, there was a lot of sort of hacking, just like, I don't need the first 2/3 of that scene. I can just come in right on that line. There was a lot of that in the last edit I did. I really got aggressive about that kind of stuff, as did Scott. You know, Scott would send me notes going, we don't need that. You can get out here. You can go right from there to there. You know, so that's the fun part.
With all your movies, what is the one or two that have the most deleted scenes, if you can recall?
Proportionally, Contagion had the most material that was shot and cut and never made the movie. There's 45 minutes of cut material that's gone.
I apologize for not knowing. Is that material available on the Blu-ray? Will it ever see the light of day?
No, I've sort of gone the other way on that.
Okay.
You know, I feel like, because I'm not a bit, I feel like all the people that went back and fucked around with their movies from the 70s, like, made them worse. So I kind of feel like, you know what, that's the movie, that's it.
Well, I think I'll get specific and say Lucas, and I think the reason why most fans are angry at him is that he never offered the original version.
Right.
And that is ultimately the problem. If you want to fuck your movie, if you want to go in and edit, more power to you,
right,
but give me the original version. So, for example, on Contagion, as a fan of yours, I would love to see this alternate version just to see it.
Right.
But as long as the other version is there, then I'm fine.
Right. Yeah, I guess I just felt, I don't, and part of me is like, I don't know if it's really fair to the actors, like the stuff that didn't make it. I don't know. I just, I used to be fine with it, and then I just suddenly wasn't. So,
sure.
Like, yeah, so.
I know you are like Guillermo in terms of you guys edit as you're shooting. When did you first start editing as you were shooting?
Well, I mean, you know, when, as soon as I started working with an editor, they would be editing while we were shooting. It's horrifying now to think that the first three films that I made, that I cut myself, I didn't start editing until we wrapped. That's unbelievable. What's changed is the ability to start editing 2 hours after you wrap the set. That's what's really been the huge difference for me, the ability that night to cut that day's stuff and make decisions about whether or not we got it, and adjust accordingly if necessary. That's been gigantic.
I have a whole bunch of things I want to ask you about. A few filmmakers asked me to ask you, are you Bituation on Twitter?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you confirmed that yet to anyone else?
I think Rich Eisen confirmed that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, either way, I don't think you tweet enough.
Well, here's the thing. I have rules about that, which is I'm not there to sell anything. And what'll happen, it's going to be streaky. What'll happen is that, as anybody who's followed the few hundred people who followed it, what happens is, like, I'll build up a bunch of stuff and then, you know, blow it out all at the same time. So I don't know if that's the way you're supposed to do it, but that's the way it's happening. So I'm about a week away from another burst of tweets, but it's fun to have, you know, it's kind of like having a pseudonym. It's kind of like being Peter Andrews. Like, you know, I feel I can hide behind that a little bit, which is fun.
Speaking of pseudonyms, where did Mary Ann Bernard come from?
That's my mother's maiden name.
I apologize for not knowing that. I probably should have.
Not many people do.
I was doing a lot of research. I should have picked up on that.
Yeah, it's funny. They're people focus more on the cinematography for some reason. I don't know why.
You recently offered to edit The Canyons in 72 hours, and I guess they said no. Am I wrong about this?
All I will say is that it seemed to me that there was no upside in that conversation ever being known outside of the room.
Right, okay.
And that I was stunned when it went outside the room.
That probably sums up that movie, though. That movie is loaded with issues.
It sure seemed like a dramatic production.
Right.
You know, but no, I know Paul. I like Paul. I never would have anticipated that any conversation about that would ever go outside the room.
Okay. Are you a little stunned at the huge success of Magic Mike?
I was. Yeah, those numbers were significantly higher than anything we hoped for. They were significantly higher than the numbers that were going to make it work for Warners, for instance. You know, they're buying North America for the amount of money that they paid was predicated on the movie doing like 60.
Sure.
Like if the movie did 60... They're like, if the movie does 60, we're gold. So to go, you know, to just fly past that, it was fun because it was so atypical. Even the way it performed was really weird day to day during the week. Like it really, Danny Feldman, the head of distribution at Warner Brothers, would just laugh. He goes, this thing, there are just no comps for the way this thing is performing. Like, it's so weird, the shifts from day to day during the week. You know, we're trying to sort of figure out, like, okay, so is it because women, like, during the week, like, they can get sitters on these days, but not on that. Like, certain days would be huge, and then the next day would be nothing. And it was just all over the place. But it's really fun when the surprise goes in that direction. What was weird was my experience has been the tracking is very strange. It tends to be very accurate about when things are going to underperform. It tends to be not very accurate and sometimes wildly inaccurate when things overperform. And Magic Mike was a perfect example. According to the tracking, we should have opened to 19. And we opened to 38 or whatever. So if I were at Warner's and I showed up Monday morning, I'd be talking to those people who do my tracking and saying, how did we miss by 100%? Like, what if I have a department that's supposed to be tracking, like, where were those people? Why can't you find out?
Do you find, because what I've been noticing recently, and mind you, this is, I'm not the guy for tracking, but I found that on Friday night, the reaction on Facebook and Twitter to your movie is huge. Right. Because at 9 o'clock, if everyone getting back from the movies is raving about it, the next 2 days are going to be huge. And if people are like, this movie's not good, all of a sudden it just goes like this. Yeah. So maybe that is playing into it.
I guess so. It's just clearly...
People really like the movie.
Yeah, no, but I think what's interesting to me is like, okay, so your methodology for figuring out who wants to see it and who doesn't is obviously got a gigantic hole in it because you're not reaching everybody that you need to reach to have like relevant data.
Sure.
You know, like if a movie, you know, if you miss by 100%, that's a lot. You know, but like I said, it tends to be very accurate when shit's going to like not perform. You know, for instance, you know, the flip side of it was Haywire. Like we knew Tuesday we were going to have a terrible weekend, and we did.
I got to tell you, I really dig that movie.
I was really happy with it and really felt like it's, a fun ride, you know, but couldn't pay people to go see it.
It is a really good movie, and she is really good, and I really think that she should be Wonder Woman.
I thought she was.
Maybe she is. I don't know.
I thought that's how she met Henry Cavill, that she did a cameo in the... Or I don't know, maybe I'm... This is another bullshit internet rumor.
You know something? It could very well be, but she is like...
No, she should be Wonder Woman. She can kick your ass.
She's great. You did second unit on The Hunger Games. I don't know if you talked a lot about that, but I wanted to bring it up. How did you get involved with that?
Well, Gary's a friend of mine. I've known him a long time. At one point, actually in the mid-90s, I was crashing on his couch for 3 weeks. And he and I, you know, we just have a history of helping each other out on stuff. I show him everything. I was a producer on Pleasantville. You know, and so we just have a long history of you know, doing each other solids, you know, when one of us needs help. So he called me in April and said, you know, I'm looking at the board of Hunger Games, and I've got these 2 days of second unit at the end of August. What are you doing? Like, can you come down and do it? I got to get somebody, you know, that I trust to do this. You know, would you be interested? I said, yeah. So I go, Contagion will be done and we won't have started Magic Mike. It's actually the perfect, like, I can literally just fly in and do it. You know, what I found really nerve-wracking about it was shooting and really worrying, you know, am I getting what he needs? Am I getting what he wants? You know, because when I'm shooting my own stuff, I know, okay, you know, I look at it and go, okay, I've got it. I need this. I got that. You know, here, I don't, you know, he's off with the first unit. I'm here. Like, I want to deliver for my friend what he needs. And so I found that aspect of it really, I was very anxious that I was getting everything that he needed and wanted. You know, and the fun part of it was my job there is to recreate exactly the aesthetic that he and Tom Stern have set up in terms of framing and lighting and movement. You know, I'm there to be a chameleon and duplicate that so that it's seamless. And I love that. I love sort of submitting to that and following their rules. So we went down, you know, we shot a ton of shit. It was really fun. And then I didn't hear from him. And I'm like, oh, no. And finally, 2 weeks later, he emailed me. He goes, I just realized I don't think I ever respond. He goes, I'm so happy with the stuff. Thank you. And I went, oh, God. Thank. I go, dude, you had me, like, completely flipped out. I thought I was going to read, like somebody else. You had to, like, redo it. He's like, no, it all worked out great. So it was fun, and that was a tough show. I was really happy that the movie took off because he worked really hard on it, you know. And it was a tough show, and I totally understood him feeling like I don't want to go back and do that again. That, you know, because I would have felt the same.
You were probably the most qualified second unit director of the last decade working on that.
It was fun.
I want to jump back real quick to the Magic Mike. Channing has talked about doing a sequel and possibly directing it himself. Obviously, you're going to go and do your own thing, but if he were to call you and say, hey, I'm doing the sequel, would you produce? Is that something you'd be willing to do? Or
I'm happy to be consigliere. You know, there's absolutely another movie to be made out of that. There were a lot of ideas that didn't make it into the first one that you know, we've had discussions about, oh, here's an opportunity to put in some of these things that we couldn't get into the first one. Like, there's a lot of good stuff still there, like stories of shit that happened to him that we just didn't have time for. And so I hope they do it, you know, and I'll help in whatever way I can. I just don't want to be, involved day to day.
Sure.
You know, but I'm happy to kind of, you know, in a sense be an executive producer and kind of weigh in on stuff. But we had a great time making that movie, and I don't have a desire to go back and try and, you know, recreate it.
You were, as you mentioned already, you produced Insomnia, you produced Pleasantville, you've produced a lot of movies. What is your typical involvement as a producer? Are you very hands-on day-to-day, or are you sort of there in the pre-production, or how do you...
Depends on the filmmaker, depends on the scale of the movie. You know, I'm sort of keying off, you know, what I think people need from me. In the case of Insomnia, like, he doesn't need me around. I went to the set one day, literally, just to say hello to everyone, and then flew back home. Like, all Chris needed was to get in the fucking door.
Right.
That was the problem, was that the head of the studio at that point didn't understand why George and I were so lit up about it. And we had to go in and go, you need to give this guy this job. Like, this is good for you. Once that happened, okay, I think you're last. We can always, you know, once he was on, you know, it was literally, I'll see you when you're done. You know, he doesn't need help like that. You know, other people want you to, you know, watch everything, give them, you know, it just depends.
Does Chris ever send you thank you cards?
No, he and I would try and have like lunch once a year just to catch up. You know what I mean? Like he's you know, he's been very vocal about, I'm so glad I got on that movie because it started this relationship with the studio that's turned out to be great for everybody. And I'm happy because it proved the sort of mandate that we had at Section 8 of taking interesting young independent filmmakers and, you know, getting them onto movies that typically would be a little more, that would be kind of normal, you know, if they weren't involved, you know, and they elevate it. They make it something more distinctive by being involved. That was our whole idea. It's like trying, it's what I did. Like, you know, I was an independent person and I came in and started working with studios on certain movies. You know, there was this whole wave of people like, you know, David O. Russell. And, you know, that was our whole idea, is blend these two things. Why can't independent filmmakers make shit that opens in 3,000 theaters? And so I'm glad that all played out,
because Chris is the perfect example of why that can work. And also, from the studio standpoint, my belief in you should bet horses, not races. You should be developing relationships with talent, not based on specific projects, but with based on the fact that you think they're talented and that everybody hits and misses. But in the long run, it's like the Clint thing. In the long run, you win. You know what I mean? Like, if somebody, for you look at my career, if one person had financed everything I've ever made, you'd be up. You know? That's, you know, I've had peaks and valleys, but over the long term, if you paid for all of them, you would have won.
100%.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so that's why it's very satisfying to watch, you know, his career turn into the career that it's turned into, because he clearly had it wasn't a surprise to me. He clearly had that in him. You know, they just initially couldn't see it.
It's interesting about him because I did a set visit on Dark Knight Rises, and I watched him work, you know, not super close, but close. And he's one of the few filmmakers that will watch over his DP's shoulder and not look at playback, which I find fascinating, because every other film set I've been on, people are watching playback.
Yeah.
And
on Out of Sight, I started like getting rid of that stuff because I felt like it was pulling the energy away from where it needs to be.
But you're shooting a lot of your stuff.
Yeah. So even when I wasn't, that's what I was doing. Like, I was doing the same thing, because I'm like, the actor needs to feel like I'm there, and this is where things are happening, not at Video Village. This is where we're making the movie here. So now, you know, what ends up happening now is there's a single monitor that the focus puller works from, because now, you know, with digital, like, you need to be shooting wide open all the time. Like, that's how it looks the best. And so, you know, your depth of field is like this. And so your focus puller has the 27-inch, you know, with his face 2 inches from the screen with the remote thing, you know, making sure, you know, you can imagine on a Fincher set the pressure that guy's under.
No, I couldn't be that guy. So there is no way.
One more? This is the last one, right?
One more.
Oh, I do.
It got shifted.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Okay, let me see what I have. I definitely want to ask you about two other things, so I'm going to make it quick. You have this, your next film, if you will, is with Michael Douglas and Matt Damon. All of us are very excited about it, and, you know, we all want to see it. What is the length of that one?
It's like an hour 50. It's under 2 hours.
What was it like making that story, if you don't mind?
Fun. Really fun. Because it had a lot of meaning for all of us by the time it happened, because it was Michael and Matt. It's for at least, you know, whatever period of time, it's the last thing that I'm going to do. And we had to postpone it because Michael got sick. So getting to do it meant a lot to all of us by the time we got there. And so it was really fun. And the good thing, I mean, as stupid as it sounds to talk about whatever this break is that I'm on, it was great knowing that that was the last one for a while, because I really appreciated everything about it every day. You know, it was in a way that you never would if you had something coming up, you know, 9 months later. You know, I really was able to kind of, you know, the people that I work with, you know, on my crew and my Greg Jacobs and, you know, like the opportunity to know like, wow, this is, you know, this is the last time I'm going to see a lot of these people for a long, you know, that made it nice, like, to be able to know that instead of suddenly you just disappear and everyone's like, what happened? You know, I was able to express my appreciation to people, you know, because I knew, like, this is going to be it for a while.
I have to wrap with you, but I definitely want to ask you, what do you think what were the one or two projects that you think you really wanted to do that just couldn't come together for financing, cast, whatever? Is there one or two?
There are only a couple. I mean, the only things that I was trying to make that I didn't get to make, what? Confederacy, Moneyball, Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Because it's a pretty small list.
Yeah, it is, considering what we did get to make. Yeah, yeah. Those are the only three that come to mind of, like, I thought they were going to get made.
I have to wrap with you, but then my last thing. The comic book genre, it seems to be the most popular thing on the planet right now. Is that something that appealed to you at one point, or not even a little?
I just wasn't a comic book guy. You know, when the Russos were going after the Captain America sequel,
totally.
They called me and said, will you call Marvel and talk to them about it, because I have a relationship with them. I said, well, I just want to, like, tell me why you want to do this. And they go, because we have a $60,000 comic book collection, because we're obsessed with this shit. And I went, okay, I'm just checking. Because I'm not. That's why I can't do one. But I didn't know that. And I just wanted to make sure that they were going after it for the right reasons.
Sure.
As it turned out, they were. And they ended up getting the job. And that's, they'll do a great job. Because they love it. And I'm just not the guy.
I understand. I got to go, or she's going to give me the hook. I want to say thank you so much
for
your time.
Maybe on the last one we'll go. We'll do a super long one.